Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference, and I am super excited for this interview where I'm talking with Dr. Sarah Myhill. To give you a bit of a background, Dr. Myhill worked for the NHS for 20 years before entering into private practice. She was the Honorary Secretary for the British Society for Allergy and Nutritional Medicine for 17 years and has worked with over 5,000 patients with fatigue. She is the author of the books Diagnosis and Treatment of CFS and ME, It's Mitochondria, Not Hypochondria, Prevent and Cure Diabetes and Sustainable Medicine. She's also the author with colleagues of three scientific studies in the International Journal of Clinical and Experimental Medicine showing that the level of mitochondrial dysfunction correlates with the degree of fatigue. Personally, I believe Dr. Myhill has done more for those with debilitating fatigue-related conditions than almost anyone else that's out there. She's one of the practitioners I personally most admire. And Sarah, I'm very grateful for you making the time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Alex. I'm delighted to be here, and I hope I shall spell out my ideas in a way that everybody can get their heads around.
I'm sure you will. So before we come into a bit more of some of the theories and your work, I'd love to just start a little bit with what got you interested in this group of patients. That I know you were, as I mentioned in the intro, you're working as a medic in the kind of NHS structures for a number of years. What inspired you? What drew you? What brought you to this point with working with this group?
Well, it was very clear from my early days in general practice that when people came to see me with whatever problem, and it doesn't matter if it was blood pressure or arthritis or whatever, they wanted to know why it was that they had that medical condition. They didn't want symptom suppression medication. They wanted to know what they could do to cure themselves. And in those early days, I can promise you, it was a struggle because medical school does not prepare one for that sort of question. Medical school and medical training is all about putting patients into a pigeonhole and then giving them symptom suppressing medication. So headache would be treated as a paracetamol deficiency, high cholesterol would be treated as a statin deficiency, and depression would be treated as a deficiency of SSRI drugs. Now that is an intellectually miserable place to be. It's not satisfying, it is not correct. There is no other professional area of profession where problems are dealt in that fashion. My family are engineering background, and if you have an engineering problem, you want to know why that bridge has fallen down, you want to know what the structural problems that went wrong that led to that, and then you come up with a solution. And it's like, it should be like a detective story. And when my girls were little, I used to tell them stories about my medicine, and I would tell them in a detective way. And I'd say, well, those are the clues, and we got a bit more clues from the tests, and then we put this hypothesis in place, and sometimes the patients were better, and sometimes they weren't. And by applying, I had one or two patients who were wonderful, happy to be experiments, and were happy to play with diet, to play with supplements, and I discovered that food allergy underpinned so many conditions. Irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, sought out their allergies and they did much better. They were cured. Similarly, migraine. You know, we all know there are some migraine triggers. It's a question of sorting out, is this an allergy? Is this a mineral deficiency? Is this an energy delivery issue or whatever? And thereby cure that migraine. Arthritis the same. I can remember I worked with a lovely doctor, Dr. Honor Anthony, who was a cancer researcher, very interested in allergies herself, and in fact ran the Airedale Allergy Centre for 13 years. I remember her telling me, all arthritis is allergy. And I remember thinking at the time, no, that can't be right. I now know she was 100% right. And if it's not allergy to foods, then it's allergy to microbes. It's allergy to microbes from fermenting gut. And rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis can all be explained in terms of that. So, of course, I worked my way through various diseases, but the one condition that was the worst treated of all were the chronic fatigue syndrome patients. They would be written up in the notes as TATT, tired all the time. It was the commonest symptom that would be presented in general practice was fatigue. What can I do to improve my energy? And these patients were getting brushed off. They've been told, oh, there's nothing wrong with you, you're just idle, you need a good night's sleep. There was no proper analysis of the condition. And so at that point, I started saying, well, if these darts, and if these supplements, and if these interventions have helped patients with migraine and inflammatory bowel disease and arthritis and cancer and whatever, let's apply the same approach to chronic fatigue syndrome. And that's really what ignited my interest in the whole business.
And it's interesting that you were saying that it's dissatisfying for medics, because often people think about allopathic medicine as the real frustration for being for the patient population. But it's interesting that you're saying that actually for you, as someone that is driven by wanting to understand and to find answers, that it was just fundamentally dissatisfying and frustrating as a model which to work with people.
Absolutely. And worse than that, the model that, you know, the so-called conventional doctors are working with at the moment, i.e. symptom suppression, has resulted in escalating pathology of new diseases because these symptoms have been ignored. And if you symptom suppress, you actually accelerate the underlying pathology. So, for example, when I was at medical school, Alzheimer's disease was pretty much unheard of. I remember the excitement of a neurological outpatient when the consultant said, oh, we've got a very special surprise for you now. It's a rare condition. You know, wow. Remember this name for your finals. You know, you'll pass with flying colors. And wow. We all went home muttering, Alzheimer's, Alzheimer's. I mustn't forget that.
That's extraordinary. Wow.
It is now the commonest cause of death in Westerners.
Yeah.
You know, Alzheimer's, dementia. It's also being called type 3 diabetes because it's a sugar problem in the brain. It all boils down to diet. But you know, what do we hear on the news about Alzheimer's disease? Oh, well, let's screen people to pick it up early. Let's find new drugs to treat it. Nonsense. We're just back to our old ways of symptom suppression thinking instead of really grasping the nettle and asking what the root cause of the problem is.
Yes. And you were saying that one of the things that drew you to the fatigue population was just how under-supported and misunderstood that group was. And I know that you've played a tireless role as an advocate for that population, at times through significant inconvenience to your own life, to put it politely. And you talk about it as being, what, you know, why that condition being so misunderstood, being the name, the blame, and the shame. So maybe just talk a little bit about that.
Well, the worst thing that has been done for patients with chronic fatigue syndrome is for them to be dumped into the psychiatric dustbin. They are told that the problem is in their brain. And the culmination of this, as you know, has been the PACE study that was published in 2011. And the PACE study purported to demonstrate that these patients could be effectively treated with cognitive behavior therapy and, worse, graded exercise therapy. Now, practitioners like you and me, who are in the know, knew that could not be right, because a condition that is defined by exercise intolerance is hardly going to be amenable to treatment by exercise. You know, it's an intellectual oxymoron. And therefore, as part of a group, we managed to get, we applied to the Information Commissioner for the raw data on which that study was made. And it was resisted. The authors of the PACE study defended that, and it cost them £200,000 to defend it, but they lost. So we then had the raw data on which that study had been based. And Dr. Keith Geraghty reanalyzed the data and came up with the result that actually it's a badly designed study. They moved the goalposts, the patients were misinformed, there'd been no long-term benefits. The whole thing was a complete fraud. And on the back of that, I reported the authors of the PACE study to the General Medical Council for scientific and, by implication, for financial fraud. Now, of course, the General Medical Council is part of the establishment. They want to keep chronic fatigue syndrome and ME a psychological condition. Why? Because it's the patient's fault. Now, I see lots of CFS ME patients triggered by exposed to poisonous chemicals, for example, Guillain-Barré syndrome. For example, the 9/11 Farman syndrome. For example, with silicon breast implants. These are all powerful chemical triggers for CFS and ME. But if the establishment admits to such, then of course the potential for compensation claims are just going to go through the roof. for, you know, for very real reasons. People have been poisoned, people have been made ill, and it's a physical condition that needs physical therapies. So of course, the response to, from the General Medical Council is to dismiss my complaint and say it has no basis. I asked the General Medical Council for the evidence base for their decision, and they have refused to give that to me.
I did find myself chuckling out loud when I was revisiting your book, CFS and NME, because you were talking about some of the interactions, let's say, you've had with the GMC over the years, and that you'd managed to get hold of some of the email correspondence. And to paraphrase, they said something like, the problem we have is that her patients seem to be getting better.
None of them will complain about her.
Exactly.
But I mean, the reason I'm pursuing this PACE complaint is because we have to throw out graded exercise therapy as a treatment for any patients because it makes them worse. And I have literally hundreds of letters, many of them have gone to the GMC, of people who have been given graded exercise therapy and not just made worse, made permanently worse.
Yes.
Now, that use of power.
I think that really is the damaging thing. And I think, of course, one of the challenges we have here is that we have a kind of cultural relationship to the medical establishment where people tend to feel that the power all lies there. And it's almost like a kind of parent-child relationship where one goes in and they're told to do something. And even though it feels completely against everything their instincts are telling them, and sometimes even more frustratingly for the people around that person, that they don't want to feel like they're not trying to get better and they're not following the advice that they're being given, that it actually takes a significant amount of courage and strength within patients to actually self-advocate and to stand up for what instinctively they know to be true for them.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. And what I've been trying to do increasingly in my writings is to give people, as I call it, the rules of the game and the tools of the trade so they can do it themselves. Because the bottom line is there are not enough therapists out there to treat all the vast numbers of ME and CFS patients that we have. But more importantly, people will get better results if they take the control of their health into their own hands, because your best doctor is yourself. The word doctor, it comes from the Greek. It means to teach. I have to teach my patients how they can cure themselves. I cannot micromanage them from day to day as to which supplements to take and when, what diet to eat, what to eat and when. They have to work it out themselves. But if they can understand what's going on, and I do try and keep my explanations at a level that I can get, i.e. simple, straightforward, biologically plausible, understandable, di-da-di-da, then they can work it out themselves. Now, I don't say it's a smooth ride, it's a very bumpy ride, because things get in the way, which we can talk about. But the basic principles of how people can get themselves out of the hole are very simple, and I'd love to go through them.
Yeah. Well, before we come a bit more into that, because one way that I think you have a conceptualizing, I think is super helpful, is you talk about analogy of a car. But I just want to make a distinction before we come to that, which is that there's obviously a spectrum of fatigue-related conditions, from a kind of at one end, people which are able to just about function in their life, but their energy is not what it should be, down to the other end of the spectrum, where someone might be completely bedbound, kind of light and sound sensitive. But to the several of the labels that tend to get used of ME and chronic fatigue, and also we have fibromyalgia and various other versions, you make a very interesting distinction between ME and CFS, which tend to get used interchangeably, tends to be more in the UK, you'll get an ME diagnosis, a bit more in the US, a CFS diagnosis, but you make a distinction between those. So maybe say a bit more about that, and that's very helpful.
The only point of diagnosis is to help us to manage. And so many diagnoses are not diagnoses, they're clinical pictures, you know.
And that's right.
Pictures, you know, fibromyalgia, achy muscles, chronic fatigue, it's a diagnosis has got to infer what we do to management. Now, there are, with the chronic fatigue syndrome, the pure chronic fatigue syndromes are the ones that have poor energy delivery mechanisms. And as you mentioned, I use the car analogy, and to have good energy delivery, you've got to have the right fuel in the tank, i.e. diet and micronutrients. You've got to have the right engine of the car, so the mitochondria have got to be functioning well. And then the control systems of the thyroid, accelerator pedal, and the adrenal gearbox have all got to be in place. and that will ensure good energy delivery. And then we have the other side of the equation. How does the body spend energy? Now, an enormous amount just goes on staying alive. It's energy we have to spend on basal metabolism, and that takes up about two-thirds of all that energy generated. So just the business of existence requires a lot of energy. And then about a third of that energy we have on top, which we can spend on physical energy, we can spend on mental energy, we can spend it on emotional energy. But I see two important holes in that energy bucket. And the biggest hole of all is the immunological hole. It's when the immune system is busy. Now, the immune system is, of course, an essential part of staying alive. It's our standing army. And you know, standing armies are a very important part of the survival of the country. But we want our standing army to be quiet. We don't want it to be playing a civil war, for example. And what's civil war? Civil war is food allergy. Civil war is autoimmunity. Civil war is action against things that are benign, that we shouldn't be fighting against. And then, of course, the immune system can be busy because it's fighting an infection. And that infection may be a low-grade infection that doesn't manifest with, you know, a boil or a pneumonia or, you know, shivers and shakes or obvious flu-like things. It can be a low-grade stealth infection, as we call them. But the immune system is chuntering away in the background, fighting that infection and draining our energy reserves. Now, if the immune system is busy, then we have symptoms of inflammation. And inflammation is characterized by heat, redness, fever, pain, and loss of function. So that gives us two very useful diagnostic pictures, if you like. I see the chronic fatigue syndromes as the people who have pure poor energy delivery mechanisms, and we have to look at their diet, their mitochondria, their thyroid, and the accelerator pedal. But if they have inflammation symptoms, and inflammation symptoms are characterized by redness, heat, pain, arthritis, joint pain, then they have chronic fatigue syndrome plus inflammation, and they are the ME patients. So just knowing if you've got chronic fatigue syndrome or chronic fatigue syndrome plus inflammation and ME has implications for management because it tells us where we need to concentrate our fire.
So that, I think that's an incredibly helpful distinction. So you mentioned briefly this analogy of a car. Let's break that down a little bit more, because I think it's a really helpful way of thinking about it. And I know that I've seen other practitioners that have kind of started to borrow this analogy in different ways, and it seems to really resonate with the patient population as well. So yeah, break that down a bit more and maybe explain particularly some of the key pieces like mitochondrial function, which we can come to in more in kind of deeper detail in a bit. But just, yeah, explain a bit more about those different elements. Yeah.
As I say, there are four big players to think about. And in order of importance, number one is diet. Now, the human beings are almost unique in the mammal world because we can run on more than one fuel. It's a little bit like a car that can run on petrol and a car that can run on diesel. We don't have one, of course. But if I put petrol into my diesel car, guess what? It ain't going to go. It might chunter along for a bit, but then it's going to break down.
And it's going to cost a bit of money as well to get that fixed.
Indeed. Well, chronic fatigue syndrome is a very expensive illness as well.
That was my joke, yeah.
But we have bodies that are designed to run on fat and fiber. That is the correct fuel for human beings. Now, we can run on carbohydrates, and we do run on carbohydrates for a short window of time during the autumn, because during the autumn, we have a carbohydrate bonanza. We have fruits, we have root vegetables, we have pulses, we have grains. And when we run on those foods, we get fat. Why? Because it spikes blood sugar, insulin spikes, and we lay that extra fuel down as fat. Now, that is a wonderful evolutionary tool to get us through the winter, because in the past, fat people survived the winter because they were insulated and they had a food supply. But primitive man didn't run on carbohydrates all throughout the whole year. He just had that window of time. What made him eat carbohydrates is addiction. Carbohydrates switch on an addiction gene, and he would have made primitive man that gene, that desire, you know, eat bananas until he couldn't eat anymore, and then eat potatoes until he couldn't eat anymore and get fat. But the problem now is we have that addiction gene. We have those foods all year round. We eat them all year round because we can. And okay, it might be very delightful, but from a health point of view, it is a disaster. And we now know that those high carbohydrate diets are driving our epidemics of Alzheimer's disease, as we mentioned earlier, of cancer, because cancer cells can only run on sugars and carbohydrates, and of heart disease and arterial disease, because they're very pro-inflammatory. So what this means is that the starting point to treat almost everything, but especially chronic fatigue syndrome, is a ketogenic diet. We have to cut out those carbohydrates. They're cheap, they're addictive, and they are making us fatigued. Now, in parallel with that, I also know that many conditions are allergy-driven. And the three allergens that come up time and time and time and time again are dairy products, gluten grains, and yeast. So the paleo-ketogenic diet is cutting out those three major groups of antigen and ketogenic so that you're running on fat and fiber. Now, this sounds awfully simple, but it is the single most difficult thing that I ask my patients to do. I spend more time talking about diet, cooking, what to eat, how to eat, what reactions to get, than everything else put together. And I have to say, these days, I don't do deals with patients anymore. Lots of people say, oh, well,
no, if negotiation.
They say to me, oh, if I give up the dairy products, can I have a bowl of fruit at the end of the day? The answer is no, I don't do deals. yes, it sounds very tough. But without that in place, if you're constantly putting the wrong fuel into your tank, you will never get well. Now, there are common stumbling blocks here. One of the stumbling blocks is that in order to fat burn, you need carnitine. And so I recommend that almost routinely with ketogenic diets. And there's another clue here, because in order to be able to fat burn, you need either adrenal hormones, you need adrenaline, or you need thyroid hormones. Now, there's a key point here. People tell me, and I'm sure you recognize the symptoms, hypoglycemia. You eat carbohydrates, blood sugar goes up, insulin is poured out, blood sugar comes crashing down, and you get all the symptoms of low blood sugar. Shakiness, irritability, anxiety, craving, got to have something to eat. Now, those are not symptoms of low blood sugar. Those are adrenaline symptoms. Now, a very common problem is people do the ketogenic diet. You expect to get into ketosis quite quickly and then to keto adapt in maybe a couple of weeks. Those people who cannot run on low carbohydrate diets are usually hypothyroid. And so this is a common stumbling block, because if they're underactive with the thyroid, they cannot use thyroid hormones to fat burn. They use adrenaline to fat burn instead. And so they get all the symptoms of low blood sugar because of their adrenaline driven. And you know, what does adrenaline do? It disturbs sleep. You know, guess what? If you can't get a good night's sleep, forget it. You're never going to get well. So the ketogenic diet is critical for good quality sleep. It's critical for good energy delivery mechanisms. And you know, I reckon that once you're well keto adapted, you only have to eat twice a day and you don't need to snack. And it's a way I test myself every day that I'm in ketosis. I have a jolly good breakfast, which is a good old fashioned fry up, and then bacon and eggs and sausage and PK bread, and there's a recipe for that, fried bread, and leftover vegetables from last night, and then that's it. Nothing throughout the day, water, yes, maybe a coffee mid-morning, and then I have a good evening meal. And by doing that, I never get hungry, I don't run out of fuel in the afternoon, and I sleep well at night. It's hard to get there, but that absolutely is the starting point.
And in many ways, what you're saying is that's really a measure, to be able to do that and sustain that, is a measure of how well the system is functioning. So that's the fuel into the car. Yes. So let's maybe come to perhaps the engine next in terms of mitochondrial function.
Yes. Now, the engine of the car was, I started getting interested in this in the 1990s. And I worked very closely with the most brilliant biochemist in the world, bar none, called John McLaren Howard. And I said to him, you know, I just had this idea that mitochondria have to be important in patients with fatigue. Now, we learn about mitochondria in biochemistry at medical school. I learned about this in the 1970s. And then what you do, you learn enough to get through your biochemistry exam and probably forget it. You know, don't have any clinical application. Well, I said to John, I want to measure mitochondrial function. And he experimented measuring respiratory enzymes and levels of various vitamins, and we didn't really find a good correlation. And then he came up with the most illuminating test, ATP profiles. Now, this is a test that measures how ATP is generated and cycled. Now, the whole point of mitochondria, what they do is they generate a molecule called ATP. And I think of ATP as money. With ATP, you can buy any job in the body. You can contract a muscle, you can conduct a nerve impulse, you can make a hormone or whatever. ATP is our central currency of function. Without ATP, we can't work. And he developed this test that shows how fast mitochondria generate ATP, how efficiently that molecule of ATP is moved from the mitochondria into the cell where it's needed to do some work, how well that ATP can be used by the cell, and how efficiently the product for ADP is recycled back into the mitochondria. And so this was a functional test. And the joy of this test is we could measure the different parameters and see how efficient each bit was and multiply it up to give us an energy score. Now, this was the first paper that John McLaren Howard and I and Dr. Norman Booth published in 2009. And we took 71 patients. I agreed how ill or how well they were with that patient. The bloods went off to Acumen Laboratories, I think it's Biolab then, for John to do the test. The results of that then went to Norman Booth. So I didn't know what the mitochondrial energy score was, the lab didn't know what the patient's energy score was, and Dr. Norman Booth did the number crunching because he's a physicist and awfully good at that. The results were breathtaking. What they showed is that those patients with the worst mitochondrial function had the lowest clinical score, and those patients with the best mitochondrial function had the best energy levels. And this was compared with a control group. And it really was a groundbreaking paper. And we subsequently published two more papers which looked at the response to treatment and the treatment regimes we were putting in place. We could demonstrate objectively were highly effective. Now, people, of course, now want to know, well, what do I have to do to get my mitochondrial function right? Because we don't have enough space in the laboratory for everybody to be tested. Now, essentially, mitochondria can go slow for one of three reasons. They can go slow because they don't have the raw materials to function. And for mitochondria to function, they've got to have magnesium, they've got to have coenzyme Q10, they've got to have acetyl L-carnitine, they've got to have vitamin B3, and if they go very slow, then some ribose helps. And they are the common micronutrient rate-limiting steps. So even if you can't get the test done, you can take that package of supplements, the details are in the books, to improve the raw materials. And then, of course, mitochondria can go slow because they're blocked by something. There's some sort of toxin getting in the way, and it might be heavy metal, it might be a pesticide residue or a piece of silicon. It might be a bar or coat protein. I suspect that the products of fermenting gut also inhibit mitochondria. So by taking a good history, maybe doing tests of toxic metals, tests looking for other things, you can get a pretty good idea of what it is that's blocking your mitochondria. And again, in the books are simple detox regimes that anybody can do. You don't have to go to an expensive clinic in South America to detox or whatever. Everybody can do all this stuff in their own home, in their own time, relatively cheaply. And the third possibility is mitochondria might be going slow because the control mechanisms are wrong. It's the thyroid accelerator pedal that's essential. And again, you could have a Ferrari car, a perfect engine, perfect fuel. But if the accelerator pedal is set at 5 miles an hour, it ain't going to win Grand Prix. And the interesting thing about thyroid hormones is not only do they determine how fast the mitochondria go, they also determine the number of mitochondria. So they make the difference between a little engine and a big engine. And guess what? You know, your Ferrari, it's only a Deschevaux 500cc, it ain't going to go, but if you've got, 5 litres in there, you've got some power. So in order of importance, we have to get the fuel in the tank right, i.e. the diet and some basic micronutrients. Then we have to sort out the mitochondrial engine, and then we fine-tune it using the thyroid and the adrenal gland. And a very helpful measure to look at the sum total of all those is your core temperature. Because if your engine is, if it's all running perfectly, you're going to be nice and warm. And if your energy delivery mechanisms are not good, then you're going to be running rather cold. And by using core temperatures, as I call it, we can fine-tune the chronic fatigue syndrome orchestra. We can adjust the dose of thyroid, and we can adjust the dose of adrenal to get it just so.
So there's a lot of pieces there. And I think for people that haven't had that explained that way, it makes an enormous amount of sense. One piece that I wanted to explore a bit more, I remember back in, I think it was about 2006, when Nikki Gratterix, who I was working with, came across the work that you guys are doing in mitochondrial function. And I seem to remember at the time, dare I confess at this point, that Biolab were not letting non-doctors do the testing. So we had a very friendly doctor sign off our testing, so we were able to use the test. But I remember that the thing that was so staggering at that point was for the first time really, there was an explanation of the delayed fatigue response which people with chronic fatigue experience. And that, up until that point, that was kind of a mystery of why somebody would be able to do something on a particular day, and it might be a stretch from what they would normally do. They would kind of be okay the day after. They might be a little bit buzzy, adrenals might be a little bit overstimulated. And then the second or the third day, they would suddenly crash. And this was something, and of course there is something, that many, many people with chronic fatigue particularly, but also fatigue, will experience. And for the first time, there was an explanation. So maybe you could say a little bit about the mechanism of how that happens.
Of course. Now, as I say, the job of mitochondria is to produce the energy molecule, which is ATP. It's called ATP because it has three phosphate groups on it, adenosine triphosphate. And in releasing a bolt of energy, it is converted to adenosine diphosphate, i.e. two phosphates on that. And it's ADP that is recycled back into mitochondria. Now, if energy demand exceeds energy delivery, and that would happen in an emergency situation, for example, if a saber-toothed tiger jumped out at you, the body can make an extra bolt of energy from two ADP molecules. Two ADP molecules can combine together to make one ATP and one AMP, i.e. 2 plus 2 equals 3 plus 1. So that gives us another ATP that gives us another bolt of energy. But what that means, the problem is that AMP, the single phosphate molecule, that can't be recycled. Mitochondria can't deal with that. That is effectively a waste product. It has to be thrown away. So if you really push the system beyond that which it can generate, you suddenly start throwing away that core molecule, ATP. Now, to recover from that situation, the body has to make brand new ATP. Now, it can make that from a sugar molecule. It can make that from glucose, which is a six-carbon molecule. There's a nasty bit of biochemistry called the pentose phosphate shunt that's necessary to chop a carbon out to make it into a five-carbon molecule. And from that five-carbon molecule, the body can then make new ATP. But that takes time. That doesn't happen instantly. That takes hours and possibly days, depending how low you run your energy resources down. And I think that is the explanation for the delayed fatigue that we see in patients with chronic fatigue syndrome, because they are always pushing themselves to their particular limit, and they are always very close to overdoing things and burnout. Now, one of the interesting little pieces that comes from that is D-ribose can be very helpful for people who have really overdone things, because D-ribose is the five-carbon molecule, which is the raw material from which we can make brand new ATP. So by giving people D-ribose, you can short-circuit that process and you can prevent that delayed fatigue. Now, I love D-ribose. It's a fantastically useful supplement. The problem is it is a sugar. I think there's potential for it to be fermented in the gut. And the way I like people to use it is as an emergency rescue molecule. So have your D-ribose ready. But if there's a day when you've really overdone things, you really overcooked it, and you know you're going to pay for it the next day, that's the time to take D-ribose. And very often people find they can prevent that delayed fatigue and thereby not waste another day of their lives.
Very, very interesting. Something else I want to break down a little bit more is that, so you were saying that the kind of three things that are key with the mitochondrial function, saying getting the raw ingredients in, and then you were talking about blockages in the mitochondria. Maybe say a little bit more about what might be some of those blockages that people experience.
Well, as you can imagine, the business of making ATP is a finely tuned process. You need all the right enzymes in the right position at the right time to generate ATP. Just one example of how incredibly efficient this is. You know, when the body is using energy fast, a molecule of ATP will recycle every 10 seconds. If you measured all the ATP, or if you weighed all the ATP that was being generated in a day, it would exceed your body weight. So it's a massively efficient system. It's incredibly busy to generate the energy. And if you throw in a poison, like some heavy metals, like some pesticides, volatile organic compounds, cleaning chemicals, hair dye, or whatever, it's like throwing a handful of sand into a finely tuned engine. Is it a good idea to chuck some sand into your Ferrari engine? I don't think so. It's going to really mess it up in unexpected ways. And you throw these chemicals in and they will block the whole business of ATP synthesis, which we call oxidative phosphorylation. It will cover the membranes of mitochondria and thereby the carrier proteins that move ATP from the mitochondria into the cell where it's being burned, or those carrier proteins that are grabbing ADP and flicking it back into mitochondria, they will be blocked. In fact, if you look at the membrane of a mitochondria, it's about 80% translocated protein. It's a little transcript that sits there, literally grabs, flicks it out, grabs ATP, flicks it back in again, grabs ATP, flicks it out, grabs ATP, flicks it back in again. You know, they are incredibly busy, incredibly active, working hard all the time. And it doesn't make much to block up those delicate works.
So what are some of the things? So obviously, if one knows that, for example, hair dye or whatever are things which are causing it, one would remove those things. But what are some of the other ways that you would deal with those blockages? If there's something historic which is in the system, how might you help work with that?
Well, essentially, there are two important ways to detox and to reduce your toxic load. And if people can't afford the test, sometimes they just do these. The commonest things that cause problems like hair dyes, antibiotic residues, pesticide residues, and so on, you can get rid of with heating regimes. Now, I've done now some tests of toxicity before and after in, well, many patients now. And I know these heating regimes work reliably well. And I don't think it matters what heating regime you use. Now, if you are a top-class athlete, and believe you me, I do have Olympic athletes coming from Sutley because they want to improve their energy delivery mechanisms, then simply running, sweating, and showering off will do the business. The point here being is that many of these toxins concentrate in fat. And of course, we have subcutaneous, we have skin, and under skin is subcutaneous fat. That is where they will be. They'll also be in the brain, and they'll also be in fat in other places in the body. But if we get hot, we physically boil those toxins off from the subcutaneous fat onto the lipid layer on the surface of the skin, and then you can wash them off from there. And of course, if you reduce the concentration in the fat, then it will redistribute from other parts of the body into that fat and be drawn out. And I now know from experience that approximately 50 heating regimes, which might be saunas, it might be far infrared saunas, it could be sunbathing, it could be a hot bath, it may be Epsom salts in there, 50 of them will halve our toxic load. Wow. And then you have another 50, and it halves it again. So the numbers come out exponentially. So you never get to zero. You never get to zero because we live in a toxic world. We're being poisoned all the time. And with the best will in the world, you can't avoid that. But you have to get that at a sufficiently low level that the body can deal with that. And they work, I say, surprisingly, remarkably well. And then we have to have techniques for getting rid of toxic metals. And there are lots of ways we can do that. We can do that with good nutrition. I mean, the problem here is we become poisoned very often, not just because of exposures, but because of micronutrient deficiencies. So, for example, if you have an enzyme in the body that needs zinc, if that person is zinc deficient, and as you know, zinc deficiency is incredibly common, if that person is zinc deficient, it'll grab something that'll look like zinc, which might be lead. And therefore, these nasty toxic metals get incorporated into the body where they really shouldn't be. So very often the body can continue to accumulate those things. So that gives a two-pronged approach to get rid of heavy metals. First of all, supply the body with lots of zinc so that when that enzyme is made again, it can grab hold of zinc instead of grabbing hold of lead. And then supply it with sulfur molecules like glutathione, which that heavy metals love sticking onto sulfur groups, which can then detox it. So just simply taking a good micronutrient together with glutathione will help to reduce your load of heavy metals. Another very useful way is to use clays in the gut, because the heavy metals get excreted in bile, the clays in the gut, doesn't matter whether you use bentonite or zeolite, or they're all much for muches, will grab those heavy metals and pull them out through the feces. I like to use DMSA or Captima, which anybody can get online, which is oral chelation therapy, works reliably well. And if you want to, you can test that very easily by measuring toxic metals in urine with DMSA to see what it pulls out. So these are all described in the books, the techniques. They're simple, accessible and available to everybody and work reliably well.
Fantastic. I'd like to go in a slightly different direction for a bit. You touched on earlier the role of fermentation in the gut. And obviously you can be eating a perfect diet, having all the things you need to have in there, and actually not be breaking down and absorbing. So say a little bit around why the gut's important, but also particularly the role of fermentation as part of this.
Okay, well again, if I spend most of my time talking about diet, the next amount of my time is spent talking about the gut.
Okay.
Let's just talk about what constitutes a normal gut. Because again, humans are almost unique in the mammal world because we can eat such a wide range of foods. We can eat vegetarian foods, we can eat meat. And if I fed my dog vegetables, she wouldn't thrive. If I fed my horses a couple of steaks a day, they wouldn't thrive either. But we can do both. And we do both because we have a two-part gut. Now, the upper gut should be a near sterile, acidic, digesting gut to deal with meat and fat. And that's where we get most of our nutrition from. And for that, we need good stomach acid, we need good enzyme production from the pancreas, and we need bile salts from the liver to emulsify that. And then as we go down the gut into the small intestine, that absorbs most of the goodness from food. And then we get into the large bowel. And the large bowel is a vegetarian department, and that's where we ferment fiber. And from fiber, we get more energy, and we get lots of good things like vitamin K and serotonin and good things like that. And we have friendly bacteria in there, which help to program the immune system. So think of the gut in two parts, and they are very different and unique. The problems arise when we start to eat too much sugar and too much carbohydrates in the upper gut. Because if we overwhelm our ability to sterilize the upper gut, and of course that depends on stomach acid, we need lots of acid in the stomach to sterilize the gut. If we overwhelm that, then the bacteria and the yeast will move in and they will happily ferment. And the cardinal symptoms of the upper fermenting gut would be reflux, burning, esophagitis. Very often patients are told they've got a hiatus hernia, which I think is a nonsense of a diagnosis. And they feel full, they get bloated, maybe get stomach pain, colic. Those are all cardinal symptoms of upper fermenting gut. Now, that brings a lot of problems. First of all, some of those products of fermentation are toxic. What do we ferment to produce? Alcohol. Delactate. Delactate acidosis in cattle clinically looks exactly like BSE. It sends them bonkers. hydrogen sulfide, which again is extremely toxic. Ammoniacal compounds, which are toxic. And the poor liver then has to deal with this fermenting nastiness that's coming from the gut. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that we are taught at medical school that we have bacteria in the gut, we have yeast in the gut, and there they remain. Not so. We now know that many of those bacteria, a small percentage of them, can get across the gut into the bloodstream. It's called bacterial translocation. If you Google it, you'll find lots of stuff on it. Now, the point is, if they are friendly bacteria that the body has been living with for billions of years, we've learned to cope with them, no difficulty at all. But if they are unfriendly upper gut fermenters, then the immune system is activated. It thinks it's being invaded by a foreigner. It thinks it's getting septicemia. And wherever those bacteria end up, you'll get inflammation. So the commonest manifestation is probably arthritis, joint pain, fibromyalgia, because guess what, connective tissue, we are largely comprised of connective tissue. But what's more intriguing is there's some lovely work done by a Japanese researcher called Nishihara. And he has demonstrated that if you've got fermenting microbes in the gut, you have got fermenting microbes in the brain. And in the brain, there is potential for them to ferment substrates like adrenaline, like noradrenaline, like serotonin into amphetamine-like substances and LSD-like substances.
Wow.
And we now know that the whole of psychosis could be explained in the terms of fermenting brain, as I call it. And guess what? What do we know from the naturopathic doctors? Much better doctors who have gone from years before me, like Abraham Hoffer, like Carl Pfeiffer. The ketogenic diet is the starting point to treat all psychosis. And guess what? Epileptics, you know, you can cure epilepsy with a ketogenic diet. You can cure brain tumors with a ketogenic diet. And you can cure psychosis with a ketogenic diet. So, that, and then the third problem, of course, we get from the ketogenic, from the upper fermenting gut, is that all the goodness in food, vitamins, the minerals that you're trying to feed it, they go to feed these wretched microbes that are flourishing in the gut. So the zinc supplements you're taking are feeding these microbes that are fermenting. So you think yourself, you're doing yourself a lot of good by giving yourself some B vitamins and some zinc and some magnesium and selenium. Not so. You're just feeding the bugs in the gut and making the problem worse. So the upper fermenting gut is a major, major problem, and we have to deal with it. And I, again, have a very simple way to deal with that. First of all, don't feed them. Don't give them the carbohydrates and sugars that they love to ferment, i.e. ketogenic diet. Secondly, kill them. And what's the best way to kill them? Good old vitamin C. Vitamin C is one of those wonderful tools that multitask, and take vitamin C to bowel tolerance, another incredibly useful tool that I use almost routinely in my patients with fatigue syndromes, almost any form of inflammation.
And do you see a role for taking things like digestive enzymes or hydrochloric acid as part of that process as well?
It may well be. If you have chronic upper fermenting gut or allergies, very often you have pancreatic insufficiency or insufficient bile salts. We can test for that very simply by doing comprehensive digestive analysis or whatever. We have good tests that give reliable answers. And yes, we must give, in the short term, the digestive aids the gut needs in order to be able to digest foods. Now, the good news is you don't have to take those digestive aids forever because the body recovers. And studied on a biolab in the mid-1990s by Stephen Davis and John McCarran Howard again showed that about a year of supplements, whether that's acid, enzymes, bile salts, bicarbonate, and digestion will correct. So it's usually, thankfully, it's a short-term need for those digestive aids. But yes, they can be absolutely vital in the recovery program.
So, fantastic. I'm mindful of time. Maybe just to kind of wrap this up and bring this together. You've for people that are watching or listening to this that have been kind of, and I'm sure there's been a lot of people, been inspired by and impacted by what you're saying. One of the things you're saying that pretty much anyone can do is a paleo ketogenic diet. What are some of the, beyond the kind of protocol specific stuff that we've explored, what are some of the other core fundamentals that you would encourage people to do? Perhaps things like pacing, sleep, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, again, I can speak all day, but the way to think about energy is what I call the Mr. Micawber quote, which from Charles Dickens, where he says, you know, income 20 shillings, you know, outgoing 19 shillings, result happiness, you know, income 20 shillings, outgoing 21 shillings, result misery.
That's very good.
To maintain a reasonable energy gap. Now, we know when we are, that energy gap is closing because we get symptoms. We get symptoms of fatigue, of stress. I think stress is the symptom the brain gives us when it knows it doesn't have the energy to deal with demand. Anxiety, depression. Depression is another symptom the brain gives us when it knows it doesn't have the energy to, you know, to use its brain. And depression makes people not spend energy. The point being that if energy demand exceeds energy delivery, then we die. So we have to have these extremely nasty and extremely unpleasant symptoms like fatigue, stress, depression, anxiety to stop us spending our last drop of energy. And that's where pacing is so important. It's terribly boring. Really, I'm no person to lecture on pacing because I don't think I could do it myself. But it is essential, and you will get better faster if you pace. Why? Because if that energy gap gets too low, we switch into anaerobic metabolism, we start making a load of AMP and draining the energy bucket, and the whole thing spirals down. So pacing is a vital part, but dead boring. But what I can tell my patients is that you put all this stuff in place and you won't have to pace forever. You'll be able to have more energy to go out and have a life with, because spending energy is all about having fun.
Fantastic. Sarah, this has been an absolute treasure trove of information. I want to mention one of your books particularly, Diagnosis and Treatment of CFS and ME, It's Mitochondria, Not Hypochondria. I think very accessible, given the level of kind of complexity that's being explored, a book that is that, you know, a layperson with fatigue can still follow and get a lot of benefit from. Maybe if you could just mention your website, which is also an amazing resource of information for people.
Yes, the website, from very early on, I wanted to make all this information free to anybody that wants to access it. And much of this stuff that is there is on the website. It's not as up to date as I would like it to be, because these days I tend to write books and my publisher would go nuts if I put all that information free on the website. But the core stuff is all there. And as I come up with fresh ideas, for example, about fine tuning chronic fatigue syndrome, or as I call it, you know, the important stuff is up there. But not every chapter of that book is there in that format. But all that information is basically there, how to do the detox. So people really can't stretch to buying the books. It's all there on the website. If you just Google Dr. Myhill, it comes up. I think it's had 16 million hits since I put it up there 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's a fantastic resource, your website. And also for practitioners that want to find out more, I know from time to time you do lectures and pieces. What would be the best place for them to kind of track the different ways they can access you?
Oh, crumbs. I do quite a lot of podcasts and webinars for the Academy of Nutritional Medicine, for the British Society of Ecological Medicine, like your good selves. So I'm ashamed to say I don't have, you know, a formal training for people. Because what I try to do is write, you know, in the books. For example, The Infection Game came out last year. And essentially, that is how to treat any infectious aspects of people with fatigue syndromes and ME. And all the details are in there, the tools of trade, like vitamin C, like heat, like light, like sunshine, like iodine. You know, they're all there, how we can treat infection using natural remedies. And yes, sometimes we need antivirals, and sometimes we need antibiotics in order to really get to the head of the game. But the starting point is all there in The Infection Game for the infectious aspects of any condition.
Fantastic. Sarah, thank you so much, not just for this interview, but also for being an inspiration and being such a leader in this field for so many years. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Alex.